Random House Audio presents Noah's Compass by Ann Tyler. Read for you by Arthur Morey. Chapter 1. In the 61st year of his life, Liam Pennywell lost his job. It wasn't such a good job anyhow. He'd been teaching fifth grade in a second-rate private boys' school. Fifth grade wasn't even what he'd been trained for. Teaching wasn't what he'd been trained for. His degree was in philosophy. Oh, don't ask. Things seemed to have taken a downward turn a long, long time ago, and perhaps it was just as well that he had seen the last of St. Dovrig's dusty, scuffed corridors and those interminable after-school meetings and the reams of niggling paperwork. In fact, this might be a sign. It could be just the nudge he needed to push him on to the next stage, the final stage, the summing-up stage. The stage where he sat in his rocking chair and reflected on what it all meant in the end. He had a respectable savings account and the promise of a pension, so his money situation wasn't out-and-out desperate. Still, he would have to economize. The prospect of economizing interested him. He plunged into it with more enthusiasm than he'd felt in years, gave up his big old-fashioned apartment within the week, and signed a lease on a smaller place, a one-bedroom plus den in a modern complex out toward the Baltimore Beltway. Of course, this meant paring down his possessions, but so much the better. Simplify. Simplify. Somehow, he had accumulated far too many encumbrances. He tossed out bales of old magazines and manila envelopes stuffed with letters and three shoeboxes of index cards for the dissertation that he had never gotten around to writing. He tried to palm off his extra furniture on his daughters, two of whom were grown-ups with places of their own, but they said it was too shabby. He had to donate it to Goodwill. Even Goodwill refused his couch, and he ended up paying 1-800-GOT-JUNK to truck it away. What was left, finally, was compact enough that he could reserve the next smallest size U-Haul, a 14-footer, for moving day. On a breezy, bright Saturday morning in June, he and his friend Bundy and his youngest daughter's boyfriend lugged everything out of his old apartment and set it along the curb. Bundy had decreed that they should develop a strategy before they started loading. Liam was reminded of a photographic series that he'd seen in one of those magazines he had just thrown away. National Geographic? Life? Different people from different parts of the world had posed among their belongings in various outdoor settings. There was a progression from the contents of the most primitive tribesman's hut, a cooking pot and a blanket in Africa or some such, to a suburban American family's football field-sized assemblage of furniture and automobiles, multiple TVs and sound systems, wheeled racks of clothing, everyday china and company china, on and on and on. His own collection, which had seemed so scanty in the gradually emptying rooms of his apartment, occupied an embarrassingly large space alongside the curb. He felt eager to whisk it away from public view. He snatched up the nearest box even before Bundy had given them the go-ahead. Bundy taught phys ed at St. Dovrig. He was a skeletal blue-black giraffe of a man, frail by the looks of him, but he could lift astonishing weights. And Damien, a limp, wilted 17-year-old, was getting paid for this. So Liam let the two of them tackle the heavy stuff, while he himself, short and stocky and out of shape, saw to the lamps and the pots and pans and other light objects. He had packed his books in small cartons, and so those he carried too, stacking them lovingly and precisely against the left inner wall of the van, while Bundy single-handedly wrestled with a desk and Damien tottered beneath an upside-down Windsor chair balanced on top of his head. Damien had the posture of a consumptive, narrow, curved back and buckling knees. He resembled a walking comma. The new apartment was some 5 miles from the old one, a short jaunt up North Charles Street. Once the van was loaded, Liam led the way in his car. He had assumed that Damien, who was below the legal age for driving a rental, would ride shotgun in the van with Bundy. But instead, he slid in next to Liam and sat in a jittery silence, chewing on a thumbnail and lurking behind a mane of lank black hair. Liam couldn't think of a single thing to say to him. When they stopped for the light at Windhurst, he contemplated asking how Kitty was, but he decided it might sound odd to inquire about his own daughter. Not until they were turning off Charles did either of them speak, and then it was Damien. "Swingin' bumper sticker," he said. Since there were no cars ahead of them, Liam knew it had to be his own bumper sticker, Damien meant. "Bumper sticker," it read, a witticism that no one before had ever seemed to appreciate. "Why, thanks," he said, and then, feeling encouraged, "I also have a T-shirt that says T-shirt." Damien stopped chewing his thumbnail and gaped at him. Liam said, "Heh-heh," in a helpful tone of voice, but still it seemed that Damien didn't get it. The complex Liam was moving to sat opposite a small shopping mall. It consisted of several two-story buildings, flat-faced and beige and bland, placed at angles to each other, under tall, spindly pines. Liam had worried about privacy, seeing the network of paths between buildings and the flanks of wide, staring windows. But during the whole unloading process, they didn't run into a single neighbor. The carpeting of brown pine needles muffled their voices, and the wind in the trees above them made an eerily, steady whispering sound. "Cool," Damien said, presumably meaning the sound, since he had his face tipped upward as he spoke. He was under the Windsor chair again. It loomed like an oversized bonnet above his forehead. Liam's unit was on the ground floor. Unfortunately, it had a shared entrance, a heavy brown steel door opening into a dank-smelling cinder-block foyer, with his own door to the left, and a flight of steep concrete steps directly ahead. Second-floor units cost less to rent, but Liam would have found it depressing to climb those stairs every day. He hadn't given much thought beforehand to the placement of his furniture. Bundy set things down any old where, but Damien proved unexpectedly finicky, shoving Liam's bed first one way and then another in search of the best view. "Like, you got to see out of the window first thing when you open your eyes," he said. "Or how will you know what kind of weather it is?" The bed was digging tracks across the carpet, and Liam just wanted to leave it where it stood. What did he care what kind of weather it was? When Damien started in on the desk, it had to be positioned where sunlight wouldn't reflect off the computer screen, he said. Liam told him, "Well, since I don't own a computer, where the desk is now will be fine. That about wraps things up, I guess." "Don't own a computer?" Damien echoed. "So let me just get you your money and you can be on your way." "But how do you, like, communicate with the outside world?" Liam was about to say that he communicated by fountain pen, but Bundy said, chuckling, "He doesn't." Then he clapped a hand on Liam's shoulder. "Okay, Liam. Good luck, man." Liam hadn't meant to dismiss Bundy along with Damien. He had envisioned the two of them sharing the traditional moving day beer and pizza. But of course, Bundy was providing Damien's ride back. It was Bundy who'd picked up the U-Haul, bless him, and now he'd be returning it. So Liam said, "Well, thank you, Bundy. I'll have to have you over once I'm settled in." Then he handed Damien $120 in cash, The extra 20 was a tip, but since Damien pocketed the bills without counting them, the gesture felt like a waste. "See you around," was all he said. Then he and Bundy left. The inner door latched gently behind them, but the outer door, the brown steel one, shook the whole building when it slammed shut, setting up a shocked silence for several moments afterward and emphasizing somehow Liam's sudden solitude. Well, so, here he was. He took a little tour. There wasn't a lot to look at. A medium-sized living room with his two armchairs and the rocking chair facing in random directions and filling not quite enough space. A dining area at the far end, formica-topped table from his first marriage and three folding chairs, with a kitchen alcove just beyond. The den and the bathroom opened off the hall that led back to the bedroom. All the floors were carpeted with the same beige synthetic substance. All the walls were refrigerator white, and there were no moldings whatsoever, no baseboards or window frames or door frames. None of those gradations that had softened the angles of his old place. He found this a satisfaction. Oh, his life was growing purer, all right. He poked his head into the tiny den, daybed, desk, Windsor chair, and admired the built-in shelves. They had been a big selling point when he was apartment hunting. Two tall, white bookshelves on either side of the patio door. Finally, he'd been able to get rid of those glass-fronted walnut monstrosities he had inherited from his mother. It was true that these shelves were less spacious. He'd had to consolidate a bit, discarding the fiction and biographies in some of his older dictionaries. But he had kept his beloved philosophers, and now he looked forward to arranging them. He bent over a carton and opened the flaps. Epictetus, Arian. The larger volumes would go on the lower shelves, he decided, even though they didn't need to, since all the shelves were exactly, mathematically, the same height. It was a matter of aesthetics, really, the visual effect. He hummed tunelessly to himself, padding back and forth between the shelves and the cartons. The sunlight streaming through the glass door brought a fine sweat to his upper lip, but he postponed rolling up his shirt sleeves because he was too absorbed in his task. After the study came the kitchen, less interesting but still necessary, and so he moved on to the boxes of foods and utensils. This was the most basic of kitchens, with a single bank of cabinets, but that was all right. He'd never been much of a cook. In fact, here it was, late afternoon, and he was only now realizing that he'd better fix himself some lunch. He made a jelly sandwich and ate it as he worked, swigging milk straight from the carton to wash it down. The sight of the six-pack of beer in the refrigerator, brought over the day before along with his perishables, gave him a pang of regret that took a moment to explain. Ah, yes, Bundy. He must remember to phone Bundy tomorrow and thank him at greater length. Invite him to supper, even. He wondered what carry-out establishments delivered within his new radius. In the living room, he arranged the chairs in what he hoped was a friendly, conversational grouping. He placed a lamp table between the two armchairs and the coffee table in front of them, and the other lamp table he set next to the rocker, which was where he imagined sitting to read at the end of every day. Or all day, for that matter. How else would he fill the hours? Even in the summers, he had been accustomed to working. St. Dovrig students could be counted on to require an abundance of remedial courses. He had taken almost no vacation, just 1 week in early June and two in August. Well, think of this as one of those weeks. Just proceed a day at a time, is all. On the kitchen wall, the telephone rang. He had a new number, but he had kept his existing plan, which included caller ID, one of the few modern inventions he approved of, and he checked the screen before he lifted the receiver. Royal, J.S., his sister. "Hello?" he said. "How's it going, Liam?" "Oh, fine. I think I'm just about settled." "Have you made up your bed yet?" "Well, no." "Do it. Now. You should have done it first thing. Pretty soon you're going to notice you're exhausted, and you don't want to be hunting for sheets then." "Okay," he said. Julia was 4 years his senior. He was used to receiving orders from her. "Later in the week, I may stop by and visit. I'll bring you a pot of beef stew," she said. "Well, that's very nice of you, Julia," he said. He hadn't eaten red meat in 30-some years, but it would have been useless to remind her. After he hung up, he obediently made his bed, which was easily navigated since Damien had positioned it so there was walking space on either side. Then he tackled the closet, where clothes had been dumped every which way. He nailed his shoe bag to the closet door and fitted in his shoes. He draped his ties on the tie rack that he found already installed. He'd never owned a tie rack before. Then, since he had the hammer out, he decided to go ahead and hang his pictures. Oh, he was way ahead of the game. Picture hanging was a finishing touch, something that took most people days. But he might as well see this through. His pictures were unexceptional. Van Gogh prints, French bistro posters, whatever he'd chosen haphazardly years and years ago just to save his walls from total blankness. Even so, it took him a while to find the appropriate spot for each one and get it properly centered. By the time he'd finished, it was after 8, and he'd had to turn all the lights on. The ceiling globe in the living room had a burnt-out bulb, he discovered. Well, never mind. He'd see to that tomorrow. All at once, enough was enough. He wasn't the slightest bit hungry, but he heated a bowl of vegetable soup in his miniature microwave and sat down at the table to eat it. First, he sat facing the kitchen alcove, with his back to the living room. The view was uninspiring, though, so he switched to the end chair that faced the window. Not that he had much to see even there, just a sheet of glossy blackness and a vague, transparent reflection of his own round, gray head. But it would be nice in the daytime. He would automatically settle in that chair from now on, he supposed. He had a fondness for routine. When he stood up to take his empty bowl to the kitchen, he was ambushed by sudden aches in several parts of his body. His shoulders hurt, and his lower back, and his calves and the soles of his feet. Early though it was, he locked his door and turned off the lights and went into the bedroom. His made-up bed was a welcome sight. As usual, Julia had known what she was talking about. He skipped his shower. Getting into his pajamas and brushing his teeth took his last ounce of energy. When he sank onto the bed, it was almost beyond his willpower to reach over and turn off the lamp. But he forced himself to do it. Then he slid down flat with a long, deep, groaning sigh. His mattress was comfortably firm, and the top sheet was tucked in tightly on either side of him, as he liked. His pillow had just enough bounce to it. The window, a couple of feet away, was cranked open to let the breeze blow in, and it offered a view of a pale night sky with a few stars visible behind the sparse black pine boughs. Just a scattering of pinpricks. He was glad now that Damien had taken such trouble to situate the bed right. Most probably, he reflected, this would be the final dwelling place of his life. What reason would he have to move again? No new prospects were likely for him. He had accomplished all the conventional tasks, grown up, found work, gotten married, had children, and now he was winding down. "This is it," he thought, "the very end of the line." And he felt a mild stirring of curiosity. Then he woke up in a hospital room with a helmet of gauze on his head. Chapter 2. He knew it was a hospital room because of the medical apparatus crowded around his bed, the IV pole and the tubes, and the blinking, chirping monitor, and because of the bed itself, which was cranked to a half-sitting position and had that uniquely uncomfortable, slick, hard hospital mattress. The ceiling could only be a hospital ceiling, with its white acoustic tiles pocked and cratered like the moon. And nowhere else would you find the same sterile taupe metal furniture. He knew his head was bandaged even before he reached up a hand to touch it, because the gauze covered his ears and turned the chirping of the monitor into a distant peep. But not until he reached did he realize that his hand was bandaged also. A wide strip of adhesive tape encircled his left palm, and in fact his palm stung sharply across the padded part now that he thought about it. Exactly where his head was injured, though, he couldn't tell. It ached uniformly all over, a relentless, dull throbbing that seemed connected to his vision, because looking at the blinking lights of the monitor made it worse. He knew from the square of pearly white sky framed by the plate glass window that it must be daytime. But which day? And what hour of the day? Any second now, an explanation would occur to him. There had to be one. He had fallen down some stairs, or he'd been in a car wreck. But when he searched his mind for his last available memory, which took a distressingly long moment, all he could find was the image of going to sleep in his new apartment. His new apartment's address was 102C Windy Pines Court. What a relief to be able to produce that. His new phone number was... oh, Lord. He couldn't recall. But that was understandable, wasn't it? The number had been assigned to him only a week ago. The exchange was 882. Or maybe 822. Or 828. He gave up the search for his phone number and returned to the image of falling asleep. He tried to invent a next act. So, in the morning he had awakened, let's say. He might have wondered where he was for an instant, but then he'd oriented himself, gotten out of bed, headed toward his new bathroom. It didn't work. He drew a blank. All he could remember was lying on his back in the dark, appreciating his sheets. A nurse came in, or maybe an aide. Hard to tell these days. She was young and plump and freckled, and she wore baby blue pants and a white smock printed with teddy bears. She punched a button on the monitor and it stopped chirping. Then she leaned over his face too close.
"Oh," she said, "you're awake."
"What happened?" he asked her.
"I'll tell them at the desk," she said.
She went off again. He could see now that a tube ran from the IV pole to his right arm. He sensed that he had a catheter, too. He was fastened down like Gulliver, trapped by cords and wires. A flutter of panic started rising in his chest, but he subdued it by staring steadily out the open door, where a blonde wooden handrail followed the corridor wall in a predictable and calming way. Surgery. Maybe he'd had surgery.
Anesthesia could do this to you, wipe out any sense that time had passed while you were unconscious. He remembered that from his tonsillectomy 50-odd years ago. But he had awakened from the tonsillectomy with a clear recall of going under and of the hours leading up to it. It had been nothing like this. Another nurse or some such person entered so swiftly that she set up a breeze. This was an older woman, but her smock was equally ambiguous, patterned all over with smiley faces.
"Good afternoon,"
she said loudly. It turned out that hearing stabbed his head just as much as seeing. She took something from her pocket, a little penlight kind of thing, and shined it painfully into his eyes. He forced himself not to close them. He said, "It's afternoon?"
"Mm-hmm."
"What's wrong with me?"
"Concussion,"
she said. She slipped the penlight back in her pocket and turned to check the monitor.
"You got a little bump on the noggin."
"I don't remember anything about it," he told her.
"Well, there you are then. That's what concussion does to people."
"I mean,
I don't remember being in a situation where I could get a concussion. All I remember is going to bed." "Did you maybe fall out of bed?"
she asked him.
"Fall out of bed? At my age?" "Well, I don't know. I just came on duty. Let's ask your daughter."
"I have a daughter here? Which one?"
"Dark hair, a little bit curly. I think she went to the cafeteria, but I'll try and track her down for you."
She checked something at the side of the bed. His catheter bag, he supposed, and then left. It was absurdly comforting to know that a daughter was here. The very word was comforting. Daughter. Someone who was personally acquainted with him and cared about more than his blood pressure and his output of pee. Even if she had absconded to the cafeteria without a backward glance. He closed his eyes and fell off a cliff, into a sleep that felt like drowning in feathers. When he woke up, a bearded man was prying open his eyelids. "There you are," the man said, as if Liam had stepped out of the room for a moment. Liam's oldest daughter was standing at the foot of the bed, her sensible, familiar face almost startling in these surroundings. She wore a sleeveless blouse that must not have been warm enough for this refrigerated air, because she'd wrapped her solid white arms around her ribcage.
"I'm Dr. Wood," the bearded man told Liam, "the hospitalist."
"Hospitalist?"
"Mr. Pennywell, do you know where you are?"
"I have no idea where I am,"
Liam said.
"What day is it, then?"
"I don't know that either," Liam said. "I just woke up." "You're asking impossible questions."
Xanthi said,
"Dad, please cooperate."
But Dr. Wood raised a palm in her direction. "Never fear. He knew how to handle these old codgers." And said,
"You're quite right, of course, Mr. Pennywell,"
in a soothing, condescending tone.
"So," he said, "the president. Can you tell me who our president is?" Liam grimaced.
"He's not my president," he said. "I refuse to acknowledge him."
"Dad,"
Liam said,
"look here, Dr. Wood. I should be asking the questions. I'm completely in the dark. I went to bed last night. Or some night. I wake up in a hospital room. What happened?"
Dr. Wood glanced at Xanthi. It was possible that he didn't know himself what had happened, or had already forgotten in the crush of his other patients. At any rate, Xanthi was the one who finally answered.
You were injured by an intruder, she told Liam.
An intruder?
He must have gotten in through the patio door, which incidentally you left unlocked for any passing Tom, Dick, or Harry to waltz through as the whim overtook him.
An intruder was in my bedroom?
I guess you struggled or shouted or something because the neighbors heard a commotion, but by the time the police came, the man had fled.
I was there for this? I was conscious? I was fighting off an attack?
He felt a deep chill down the back of his neck, and it wasn't from the air conditioning.
They need to keep you here a while for observation, Xanthi told him. That's why they've been waking you so often, to ask you questions.
It was news to Liam that he had been awakened often, but he didn't want to admit to yet another failure of memory.
Have they caught the man?
He asked her.
Not yet. He's still out there?
Before she could answer, Dr. Woods said,
Sit up for me, please, Mr. Pennywell.
Then he led Liam through a series of exercises that made him feel foolish. Raise this arm. Raise that arm. Touch his own nose. Follow Dr. Wood's finger with his eyes. Xanthi stood to one side, narrowly watchful, as the soles of his bare feet were scraped with a pointed object. During the whole process, Dr. Wood remained expressionless.
How am I?
Liam was forced to ask, finally. Dr. Wood said,
We'll need to keep you here another night, just to be on the safe side. But if all goes well, we can release you tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Xanthi said. Are you serious? Look at him. He's weak as a kitten. He looks like death warmed over.
Oh, that will change, the doctor said offhandedly. He told Liam,
Nothing to eat today but liquids, I'm afraid, in case we have to take you very suddenly to the O.R.
Then he nodded in Xanthi's direction and left the room.
Typical,
Xanthi muttered when he'd gone.
First, he says, they're booting you out, and then in the same breath he says you may need emergency brain surgery.
She spun away with a flounce of her skirt. Liam feared for a moment that she was leaving too, but she was only going over to the corner for a green vinyl chair. She dragged it closer to his bed and plunked herself down in it.
I hope you're satisfied, she told Liam.
Well, not completely, he said dryly. I knew you shouldn't have moved to that place. Didn't I tell you when you signed the lease? A 60-year-old man in a rinky-dink starter apartment directly across from a shopping mall. And then to leave your door wide open. What did you expect?
He hadn't left his door wide open, and he hadn't meant to leave it unlocked. He hadn't known it was unlocked. But it was his policy not to argue. An infuriating policy, his daughters always claimed.
Arguing got you nowhere.
He smoothed down his bedclothes with his good hand, accidentally tugging the tube that ran from his arm to the IV pole.
A 60-year-old man, Xanthi said, who can still move all his belongings in the very smallest size U-Haul.
Next smallest, he murmured,
whose so-called car is a geoprism, a used geoprism, and who, when he gets hit on the head, nobody knows where his people are.
How did they know?
He asked. It only now occurred to him to wonder.
Who called you?
The police called?
They'll be in to question you later, they said. They got my number from your address book. I was the only entry with the same last name as yours.
I had to hear it over the phone at 2 o'clock in the morning. If you don't think that's an experience.
He was accustomed to Xanthi's rants.
They were sort of a hobby of hers. Funny. She was so completely different from her mother, his first wife, a waifish, fragile musician with a veil of transparent hair. Millie had taken too many pills when Xanthi was not yet two. It was his second wife who'd ended up raising Xanthi, and his second wife whom she resembled. Brown-haired and sturdy and normal-looking, pleasantly unexceptional-looking, he wondered sometimes if genetic traits could be altered by osmosis.
"And here's the worst of it," Xanthi was saying. "You invite a known drug addict into your home and give him total access."
"Excuse me?" he said. He was startled. Had there been some whole other episode he had lost to his amnesia?
"Damien O'Donovan, what were you thinking?"
"Damien? Kitty's Damien? Kitty's boyfriend?
Kitty's drug addict slacker boyfriend whom none of us trust for an instant? Mom won't even let them be alone in the house together."
"Well, of course she won't," Liam said. "They're 17 years old. But Damien's not a drug addict."
"Dad, how can these things slip your mind? He was suspended last year for smoking pot backstage in the school auditorium."
"That doesn't make him an addict."
"He was suspended for a week. But you're such a patsy. You choose to forget all about it. You say, 'Oh, here, Damien, let me show you where I live. Let me point out my flimsy patio door that I plan to leave unlocked.' In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if he unlocked that door himself while he was there, just so he could get back in and mug you."
"Oh, for heaven's sake," Liam said. "He's a perfectly harmless kid. A little vacant, maybe, but he would never..."
"I don't want to say you had it coming," Xanthi said. "But mark my words, Dad. Those who cannot remember history are condemned to repeat it. Harry Truman."
"The past," Liam said reflexively.
"What?"
"Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And it's George Santayana."
Xanthi gazed at him stonily, her eyes the same opaque, dark brown as her stepmother's.
"I'm going to find some place where my cell phone works and let the others know how you're doing," she said.
Even though she could be a bit wearing, he was sorry to see her leave. His head was pounding so hard that it made a sound inside his ears like approaching footsteps. His injured palm was stinging, and something seemed to be wrong with his neck. A twisty pain ran down the left side.
He had fought with someone? Physically struggled?
"Let's try this again." He had gone to bed in his new bedroom. He had felt grateful for his firm mattress, his resilient pillow, his tightly tucked top sheet. He had looked out the window and seen the stars sprinkled above the pine boughs.
Then what? Then what? Then what?
His lost memory was like a physical object just beyond his grasp. He could feel the strain in his head. It made the throbbing even worse.
"Okay. Just let it go. It would come to him in good time."
He closed his eyes and slid toward sleep, almost all the way, but not quite. Part of him was listening for Xanthi. What was she telling her sisters? It would be nice if she were saying, "Such a scare. We almost lost him. I've been out of my mind with worry." Although more likely it was,
"Can you believe what he's done this time?"
But it wasn't his fault, he wanted to say. For once, he wasn't to blame. He knew his daughters thought he was hopeless. They said he didn't pay attention. They claimed he was obtuse. They rolled their eyes at each other when he made the most innocent remark. They called him Mr. Magoo. At St. Dovrig once, invited to view a poem on the English department's computer, he had clicked on How to Listen and been disappointed to find mere technical instructions for playing the audio version. What he had been hoping for was advice on how to listen to poetry, and by extension, how to listen, really listen, to what was being said all around him. It seemed he lacked some basic skill for that. He was hopeless. His daughters were right. He reached for sleep as if it were a blanket that he could hide underneath, and finally he managed to catch hold of it. When he opened his eyes, a policeman was standing at his bedside, a muscular young man in full uniform. "Mr. Pennywell," he was saying. He already had his ID card in hand, not that one was needed. Nobody would mistake him for anything but a cop. His white shirt was so crisp that it hurt to look at it, and the weight of his gun and his radio and his massive black leather belt would have sunk him like a stone if he had fallen into any water. "Like to ask a few questions," he said. Liam struggled to sit up, and something like a brick slammed into his left temple. He groaned and eased himself back against his pillow. The policeman, oblivious, was tucking away his ID. If he had given his name, he must have done so before Liam woke up. He took a small notebook from his breast pocket, along with a ballpoint pen, and said, "I understand you left your back door unlocked."
"That's what they tell me."
"Pardon?"
"That's what they tell me," I said.
He had thought he was speaking quite loudly, but it was hard to know for sure inside all that gauze.
"And when did you retire?"
the man asked, writing something down.
"I'm not exactly calling it retirement yet."
"Pardon?"
"I'm not exactly calling it retirement yet. I'll have to see how my money holds out."
"When did you go to bed, Mr. Pennywell?"
"On the night of the incident."
"Oh."
Liam reflected for a moment.
"Wasn't that last night?"
The policeman consulted his notebook.
"Last night, yes," he said. "Saturday, June 10th.
"You called it the night of the incident?"
"Right,"
the man said, looking puzzled.
"It was your wording, you see, that caused me to wonder."
"Caused you to wonder what, Mr. Pennywell?"
"I meant..." Liam gave up. "I don't know when I went to bed," he said. "Early, though."
"Early. Say 8?
8?
Liam was scandalized. The policeman made another notation.
8 o'clock. "And how soon after that would you guess you fell asleep?" he asked.
"I would never go to bed at 8.
"You just said..."
"I said early. But I didn't mean that early."
"Well, when, then?"
9, maybe,"
Liam told him.
"Or, I don't know."
"What?
You want me to make something up? I don't know what time. I'm completely at a loss here, don't you see? I don't remember a thing."
The policeman crossed out his last notation. He closed his notebook in an ostentatiously patient and deliberate way and slid it into his pocket.
"Tell you what," he said, "we'll check with you in a few days. Oftentimes a thing like this comes back to folks by and by."
"Let's hope so,"
Liam said.
"Pardon?"
"Let's hope it comes back."
The policeman made a sort of gesture, half wave and half salute. and left. Let's hope so, dear Lord in heaven. Even if it were some violent, upsetting scene. Well, of course it would be violent and upsetting. He needed to retrieve it. He thought of those slapstick comedies where a character is beaned and conks out and forgets his own name. Then he somehow beaned again, and magically he remembers. Although even the thought of another blow to his head caused Liam to wince. Too late, he realized that he should have asked the policeman some questions of his own. Had any of his belongings been stolen? Damaged? What state was his apartment in? Maybe Xanthi would know. He turned cautiously onto his side so that he was facing the doorway, watching for her return. Where was the girl? And how about her sisters? Weren't they going to visit? He seemed to be all alone here. But the next steps he heard were the squeegee soles of a tall, skinny aide with a tray. Supper, she told him. What time is it? He asked. The sky outside his window was still bright. She threw a glance at a giant wall clock that he somehow hadn't noticed before. 5:25, she did not bother saying. She set his tray on a wheeled table and rolled it toward him. Jello, a steel pot dangling a teabag tab, and a plastic cup of apple juice. She left without another word. Inch by inch, he hauled himself up and reached for the juice. It was sealed with a tight foil lid that turned out to be beyond him. Pulling it completely off took more strength than he could muster just now, and the harder he tried, the more mess he made. Because he had to squeeze the cup with his bandaged hand, and the plastic kept squashing inward and spilling. Finally, he lay back exhausted. He wasn't hungry anyhow. The distressing thing about losing a memory, he thought, was that it felt like losing control. Something had happened, something significant, and he couldn't say how he'd comported himself. He didn't know if he had been calm or terrified or angry. He didn't know if he'd acted cowardly or heroic. And here he'd always taken such pride in his total recall. He could quote entire passages from the Stoics, in the original Greek if need be. Although remembering a personal event, he supposed, was somewhat different. He had never been the type who dwelt on bygones. He believed in moving on. He used to tell his daughters any time they threw one of those tiresome blame-the-parents fits that people who are true adults do not keep rehashing their childhoods. Still, this was the first time he had experienced an actual gap. A hole, it felt like. A hole in his mind, full of empty, blue, rushing air. He had lain down in his new bedroom. He had felt grateful for his firm mattress and his bouncy foam rubber pillow, his tucked-in top sheet, the open window, the stars beyond the pines. By morning, the ache in his head had grown more localized. It was specific to his left temple. He believed he could detect a goose egg there, not from the contour of it, since his bandage was so thick, but from the way a certain spot leapt into full-blown pain before the surrounding area when he pressed tentatively with his fingers. There was still no sign of Xanthi. Had she come and gone again while he was sleeping? A stream of other people passed through, though. A woman took his vital signs. Another brought him breakfast. Toast and eggs and cornflakes. He must have graduated to solids. A third woman freed him of his IV tube and his catheter, after which he tottered into the bathroom on his own. In the mirror, he looked like a derelict. The white gauze helmet gave his skin a yellowish cast, and he had a stubble of gray whiskers on his cheeks and bags under his eyes. Of course, his scalp wound was impossible to see. But once he was safely in bed again, he set to work unwinding the adhesive tape from his hand. Underneath, he found blood-spotted gauze. Under that, 2 inches of coarse black stitches curved across his swollen and discolored palm. He was sorry now that he'd looked. He replaced the tape as best he could and lay back and stared at the ceiling. If his attacker had knocked him out while he slept, the knot on his head would have been his only injury. It was clear then that he must have been awake. Either that, or he had awakened as soon as he heard a noise. He must have raised a hand to protect himself. The woman who'd brought his breakfast tray returned for it and tut-tutted. "Now, how are you going to get your strength back not eating more than this?" she asked him. "I did drink the coffee." "Right. That's a big help." Encouraged, he said, "I wonder if I could have a phone in my room."
"You don't have no phone?"
"No. And I need to call my daughter."
"I'll tell him at the desk," she said.
But the next woman who entered carried a compartmented box of medical supplies. "I'm Dr. Rodriguez," she told him. "I'm going to change your dressings before we send you home." "Well, but my daughter's not here," he said.
"Your daughter?
How will I get home on my own?"
"You won't. You're not allowed. Somebody has to drive you, and somebody has to keep an eye on you for the next 48 hours.
She set her supplies on his table and selected a pair of scissors sealed in cellophane. Liam doubted that she was past 30. Her glowing olive skin lacked the slightest wrinkle, and her hair was inky black. Maybe you needed to be older to realize that it wasn't always easy to find someone who would stick around for 48 hours at a stretch. He closed his eyes while she snipped at the gauze around his head, and then he felt a coolness and lightness as she pried it away. She said once it was off. She peered closely, pursing her lips. "What's it look like?" She slid a drawer from beneath his table. For a moment, he thought she was leaving his question unanswered, but it turned out she wanted to show him his reflection in a little pop-up mirror. He saw first a flash of his neck, old, and then the side of his head. His short gray hair shaved away to reveal a purple swelling on his scalp and a shallow V of black threads dotted with dried blood.
"Fairly clean edges," the doctor said, folding away the mirror. "That's good."
She unwrapped a square of gauze and stuck it in place with adhesive tape. No more helmet.
"Your primary care physician can take the stitches out. We'll give you written instructions when you leave. Now let me see your hand."
He held it up and she unwound the tape without much interest and applied a fresh strip.
"I'll write a prescription for pain pills, too," she said, "just in case you need them."
She dumped the old dressings, the paper wrappers, and even the scissors into a red plastic bin. The scissors clattered so loudly that they hurt his head. Such wastefulness, not even recycled. But he had more important things to discuss.
"Is it all right to go home in a taxi?" he asked.
"Absolutely not. Somebody should be with you. Do you not have anybody? Should we be getting in touch with the social worker?"
For a minute, he thought she was referring to Xanthi, who happened to be a social worker herself. When he realized his mistake, he flushed and said,
"Oh, no, that won't be necessary."
"Well, good luck," she told him.
She picked up her box of supplies and walked out. As soon as she was gone, he pressed the call button on his bed rail.
"Yes?"
a voice crackled from some invisible spot.
"Could I have a telephone, please?"
"I'll ask."
He sank back on his pillow and closed his eyes. How could he have ended up so alone? 2 failed marriages, for he had to count Millie's death as a failure, 3 daughters who led their own lives, and a sister he seldom spoke to. The merest handful of friends, more like acquaintances, really. A promising youth that had somehow trailed off in a series of low-paying jobs far beneath his qualifications. Why, that last job had used about 10% of his brain. And he should have stood up for himself when they fired him. He should have pointed out that if they really needed to reduce the 2 fifth-grade classes to 1, he ought to be the teacher they kept. He was way, way senior to Brian Medley. Brian was hired just 2 years ago. But instead, he'd tried to put a good face on it. He'd tried to make Mr. Fairborn feel less guilty for letting him go. "Certainly," he had said, "I understand completely." And he had packed up his desk drawers when no one else was around to feel discomforted by the sight. "Why make a scene?" he had asked when Bundy voiced his outrage. "No sense clinging to resentments," he'd said. He must not even have clothes to go home in. Not day clothes, at least. Just pajamas. He was naked and alone and unprotected and unloved. Well, this was just a mood he was in, created by current circumstances. He knew it wouldn't last. Before they could bring him a telephone, if they ever planned to, his ex-wife arrived. Cheery and purposeful, hugging a paper grocery bag from which his favorite blue shirt poked forth, she breezed in, already talking. "My goodness, what it takes to track a person down in this place. The switchboard said one room, the reception desk said another." Liam felt so relieved he was speechless. He stared round-eyed from his bed, clinging to the side of her. She was a medium sort of woman. Medium in every way. Medium length, curly brown hair finely threaded with gray. Medium weight figure. And that lipstick-only makeup style that's meant not to draw attention to itself. Her clothes always looked slightly unkempt. The belt of her shirtwaist dress today rode inches above her waistline. But she would have gone unremarked in almost any gathering. He used to have trouble recalling her face when they were dating. This had seemed a plus, he remembered. Enough of those lovely, poetic, ethereal women who haunted a person's dreams. "It's good to see you, Barbara," he told her finally. Then he had to clear his throat.
"How are you feeling?"
"I'm okay."
"Awful experience," she said blithely. "I can't imagine what the world is coming to."
She sat down on the green vinyl chair and started rummaging through her bag, producing first the blue shirt, and then a pair of over-the-calf black silk socks, not what he would have chosen to wear with the khakis she drew out next.
"If you can't sleep safely in your own bed..."
Liam cleared his throat again. He said,
"I don't think it was Damien, though." "Damien?"
"Xanthi believes Damien was the one who clobbered me." Barbara waved a hand and then bent to set his black dress shoes on the floor beside the bed.
"I'm sure I brought underpants,"
she murmured, peering into the bag.
"Ah, here they are." "Well, you know Xanthi. She thinks pot's the first step to perdition."
Barbara used to smoke a bit of pot herself, Liam recalled. She could surprise you sometimes. For all her medium looks and her stodgy school librarian job, she'd had a fondness for rock music, and she used to dance to it like a woman possessed, pumping the air with her soft white fists and sending her bobby pins flying in every direction. This was back in the days when they were still together, before she gave up on him and filed for divorce. Strange how distinctly, though, that image all at once presented itself. Maybe it was a side effect of the concussion.
"Do you still like Crack the Sky?" Liam asked her.
"What?"
she said.
"Oh, mercy, I haven't listened to Crack the Sky in ages. I'm 62 years old. Put your clothes on, will you? Heaven only knows when they'll spring you, but you might as well be ready once they do."
From the way she held out his underpants, stretching the waistband invitingly and cocking both her pinkies, it seemed she might be expecting him to step into them then and there. But he took them from her and gathered the rest of his clothes and padded off to the bathroom, clutching his hospital gown shut behind him with his free hand.
"After we get you settled at home," she called from her chair, "the girls and I will keep in touch by telephone to see that you're okay."
"Just by telephone?" he asked.
"Well, Aunt Kitty's going to come spend the night with you as soon as she gets off work. She's found herself a summer job filing charts in our dentist's office."
"Your dentist's open on Sunday?"
"It's Monday."
"Oh.
We'll phone and ask if you know your name, just to make sure you're compos mentis, or where you live, or what day it is."
There was a sudden pause. Then she said,
"You thought it was Sunday?"
"That could happen to anyone. I just lost track is all."
He had to sit on the toilet lid to put his socks on. His balance seemed a bit off, and bending down made his head throb.
"They told us you should be under constant observation, but this is the best we can manage," he heard through the slit in the door. "Xanthi works such impossible hours, and Louise, of course, has Jonah."
She didn't say why she couldn't do it, with her luxurious summer schedule, but Liam didn't point that out. He shuffled from the bathroom in his stocking feet, holding up his trousers. Barbara seemed to have forgotten his belt.
"Could you hand me my shoes, please?" he said as he sat on the edge of the bed.
48 hours is the amount of time they told us,"
she said. She bent for a shoe and, without being asked, fitted it onto his foot and tugged the laces snug and tied them. He felt well-tended and submissive, like a child. She said,
"I did call your sister. Has she been in touch?"
"This room doesn't have a phone."
"Well, she'll probably call once you're home. I told her you'd be discharged today. She wants you to get a burglar alarm as soon as possible."
He nodded, not bothering to argue, and raised his other foot. Then there was a period of limbo while they waited for his paperwork. Barbara took a crossword puzzle from her grocery bag, and Liam lay back on the bed, shoes and all, and stared at the ceiling. The few times he'd been hospitalized before, he could hardly wait to leave, he remembered. He'd pressed his call button repeatedly and kept sending whoever was with him out to the nurse's station to see what the holdup was. But now he was grateful for the delay. At least here he wasn't alone. He felt lazy and content, and the sound of Barbara's pencil whispering across the paper almost put him to sleep. Imagine he was a man who lived in the hospital permanently. He'd been born here, and he had somehow never left. His meals, his clothes, his activities, all taken care of. No wonder, therefore, he had forgotten how he had arrived. He had been here all along. This was the sum of his world. There was nothing more to remember. Eventually, though, a nurse came with his prescriptions and instructions. She perched on the very edge of his bed, giving off a smell of mouthwash, and went over the doctor's orders line by line. "You can't be alone for the next 2 days, and you can't drive your car for a week," she said.
"A week?"
longer than that if you experience the slightest sense of vertigo.
You're being unreasonable, Liam told her.
And it's crucial to complete the full course of antibiotics. There is nothing on Earth more septic than the bite of another human being.
A what? He said. A bite?
The bite on your hand.
I was bitten?
A sickish zoom hit the bottom of his stomach, as if an elevator had dropped. Even Barbara looked taken aback.
Well, not on purpose, maybe, the nurse said. But from the shape of the wound, they think you must have flailed out and made contact with the other guy's teeth.
She gave him a smile that was probably meant to be reassuring.
So it is very, very important to take these pills for the full 10 days, she said. Not 9 days, not 8 days.
Liam lay back and covered his eyes with his good hand. On purpose or not, there was something so intimate about a stranger's biting him. After that, they had the usual endless wait for a wheelchair, and Barbara used the time to go off to the hospital pharmacy and get his prescriptions filled. Liam picked up her crossword puzzle and studied it while she was gone. Famous World War II battlefield, and birthplace of FDR, and palindromic Ms. Gardner. She had known them all, good librarian that she was, and so did Liam, or at least he recognized her answers as correct once he saw them. But stressful occupation gave him an itch of anxiety deep inside his skull, the way riddles used to when he was a child. Poet, Barbara had answered, so confidently that the cross of the T flew tip-tilted across the upright. He felt overcome with discouragement, and he dropped the puzzle onto the bed.